as a teacher, one of the things I tell my students is that the process of writing is the process of finding your voice on paper. And only you will be able to develop that. You can't write somebody else's stuff. That's not going to work. And especially in this business, you have to be able to, you know, continue on with your voice, because that is what's going to stand out at the end of the day. And they also the reason why you will get hired for a project or not. And while you might doubt yourself at certain times, you constantly are trying to develop that. And it's just, it's the process of not quitting. It's hard, and it's not for everybody, and it's, you know, the world is not forgiving sometimes at the same notion, but the ability of not quitting will keep you getting better and keep you moving forward, and never giving up is I think part of the process of, you know, finding your own voice.
Today I'm hoping to surprise you with a conversation with the legendary Casey Weiland, creator of the hit podcast We're Alive. With more than 200 million downloads, it's one of the most successful and longest running show. Casey is like a true pioneer and veteran in the audio world, as We Are Live starting in 2009. Based on the success of We Are Live, Casey was able to launch Weiland Productions, and now he directs Bronzeville with Lawrence Fishburne, and he's developing two new Audible originals. Casey and I share the same passion for film, business, and teaching. So we do are going to go in depth in creativity and storytelling and how his personal experiences informed his work. And most notably, his time in the army, which inspired many characters and the setup in the world of We Are Live. On the CryptoZ side of things, we are finishing episode 10, the last episode of this first season. So we're almost there. Something really great happened to CryptoZ. And we learned a month ago that he was selected to participate to a very important film event called IFB Film Week. And this has been quite influential in our thinking of releasing the second half of this first season in time for the event. But don't worry, the event is at the end of September, so you won't have long to wait. Plus, we'll find a way to share those episodes early with our supporters. If you'd like to be notified when the episodes come back, no problem. You can text 646-229-3423 and we will text you when we're ready to reboot. We're going to go offline next week, but I hope to come back with other fascinating interviews and conversation. In the meantime, this might be a great opportunity to discover Gold Rush, which is the latest season of We Are Live. And now, let's meet with Casey Weiland. Hey, Casey, thank you so much for joining us here. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. How are you doing on this fine Friday morning?
Good, good. We're doing our best to overcome the situation. This week we attacked the last episode, episode 10.
Oh, wow. Congrats.
Yeah, it's exciting. I'm like ready to get them out. I think people are also ready for them to get them out because they're tired to hear my voice.
Yeah, it's an interesting cycle of having to continually create new things and then go back to the production and spend as much time as you can before you run out and then you have to get something new out again.
So I've looked at your feed and I realized you published your first episode on May 4th, 2009. And it reminded me that I published my first episode on May 4th, 2020.
Hey, and that's a good span. It's a good day.
You know, I thought I was early and I was kind of being a smart ass. But then I realized, oh my God, that guy had the idea like 11 years ago. Like, I'm just amazed. Like, what can you take me a little bit back then and how you kind of came to think that that was a great opportunity?
Sure. So back then, there were very few podcasts. In 2009, it was not exactly something that was easy to do. Also, the devices that we had, in order to download podcasts, you had to hook up your iPod to the computer, download the episode, and then sync it to your iPod. I mean, it was a much more difficult process to do, but the system was there, which was nice. And in terms of what other content was out there was very few other pieces of narrative audio drama that were out there at the time. Some of them were few and far between. Some of them didn't have a good release schedule, and it kind of felt like the atmosphere was a little bit, you know, not great. It was kind of missing something. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I had been working on various animations for my senior thesis. And I had spent over a year, more than that, probably several years doing my senior thesis, developing the animation, the backgrounds, the characters, settings, all this stuff. And it's so time-consuming that I was getting really burned out on that kind of process. So I thought, okay, well, let me look at the final product. And the final product for my animation was not great. I will be the first to admit it, that it was kind of a failure. It wasn't that great. It was hard to watch at times. And I kind of looked at it like, okay, this is not good.
Right.
But what I did realize through that whole process was that the audio and the process of recording the voices was something that was good. The idea that having all the characters in the same room at the same time, being able to record together, you were able to get something that was a little bit more magical, that the voices themselves had a standout quality over the animation. And honestly, it was something that you could enjoy listening to more than you could actually viewing. So I was like, okay, that's a quality you can take away from. And so I sort of started to think about it, and I was like, I had a whole bunch of other stories that I wanted to tell. One of them was I always wanted to do a zombie survival story, because I always felt that I didn't like many of the ones that were done. I didn't think that they didn't have the good scientific approach. So that sort of was the style. And I was like, okay, we have this great thing to do. We can tell stories with audio. We have podcasts, which is a direct-to-consumer publishing platform. Let's do this, and let's do something on a regular basis, get people together, and take all the things that I sort of learned from doing films and animation and apply them to the audio world, and sort of the two met together for We're Alive.
Did you have any concept of, like, I could probably start it as an audio and maybe that will become something that I can do for TV later, and I can maybe start this, build an audience and build a production and a business around it? Was that in your mind at all, or you were just like...
Oh, yes. No, and that's honestly kind of been in my mind the entire time is, you know what, there are no survival horror stories on television. So if I create something as an audio drama first, maybe someone will notice it and then pick it up, and then it'll make... You know, then that'll be our way to kind of go to the next level. Walking Dead ended up coming out the next year, I will add.
Right.
So we were ahead of the stream, but not enough, unfortunately. Because the funny thing about stories is stories will go through any medium. They'll go from books, they'll go from TV, animation, comic book. I mean, a good story is a good story in whatever medium it is in, as long as you take advantage of why that medium is
right
the way it is. And so that was my approach is make this the best that you can for audio. And then when hopefully somebody enjoys it enough and sees that it's got some viability, it can go to the next, medium from there and continue on, because, you know, I like telling stories, and for me, I'm a storyteller first before, you know, an audio dramatist or an audio enthusiast. It's just a really good medium that I tend to understand, from, you know, working in it for so long.
So having done my first season for my first show, I'm trying to, like, put myself in your shoes, you know, 11 years earlier. And I heard, and you can tell me if that's a true story or not, that you were sometimes going outside of movie theaters waiting for, like, horror films to finish to kind of grab the people coming out of the theater and give them flyers for Real Life.
Oh, I was giving CDs.
CDs of the show?
I was full on giving CDs of the show. We ended up going to, like, midnight premieres of Zombieland to give out CDs to anybody who was willing to listen, because I wanted to grab fans as any way possible, because guerrilla marketing, the best that you can, and get some people that way. And ended up getting a producer on, or intern that became a producer on the show later on from one of those sessions. It's kind of funny how that worked out.
That makes total sense now, because I was like, did people even know about podcasts? And then I had to imagine, because even sometimes I have to do that. I have to teach people how to go and find a podcast in the first place, because if some, you know, still some people have never heard one.
Oh, yeah. And back then, nobody heard of a podcast.
No one.
And also, they were limited to what platform you were on. Like, There was the Zune marketplace, actually, and Zune was a big thing at that time for a certain amount of people, and there was a big Zune podcast market. That was an option. But even then, it was still very limited in what people had devices they could use them.
What was it about podcasting that made you believe at that time that that was something exciting? Like, how did you keep, I'm imagining the first two years probably were probably difficult.
Yeah, I mean, that the distribution network that is podcasts is hard for people to find it. But at the same time, it's completely controlled by you. That's the nice part about it, is there's no middleman. It was just basically you and your show and then, you know, the consumer. And there was nothing in between that. And so it was a great way of for me, being able to just go from nothing to something and put myself in the pockets of anybody out there who really wanted to listen. So it was a really great medium to do that, and it still is. There's still, I mean, the business model has completely changed now. I mean, there's a lot of people who control different feeds and working with different podcast conglomerates. But still, at the core, the servers themselves are free and clear. They are not managed by anybody outside of those server bases.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you how your perspective and about the medium and podcasting had changed since you started and how you thought it might be going next.
Well, it's one of the things about podcasting is that, and this is kind of the nature of the beast in terms of like we're alive as well, is it does get more expensive the more complicated you get. And also the better you want to make it, it also gets a little bit more expensive. And it's the pool is getting, there's a lot of people in the pool now. There's a lot of podcasts out there. You're competing for the ears of other people. And so being able to work together with other companies and have podcast, you know, teams and the business model has changed enough to where it's like, okay, it's growing pains. It's, you know, you get more podcasts, but then you have more competition.
Right.
You want to do better content, but it costs more. So it's like a give and take between all these things where you constantly want to try and like improve and make things better. But also at the same time, there are a lot more add-ons that kind of come with that in a way. So we'll see a lot more, like Spotify is getting into the podcast game, funding more projects. Personally, I've always been one of those people that thinks that content is king. And if you build it and make a great story, they will continue to come. Because with our medium, thankfully, with audio dramas and audio fiction, it's evergreen content. It doesn't expire. The minute that somebody has a talk show, the minute the words leave their mouths, it starts to expire. But with our content, it's not the same. It's very unique in that
way. Right. There's basically like two models that I'm witnessing. Either the creators who focus on their content and focus on building an audience on Patreon, for example, that will sustain their production and just hone on to that and develop their personal shows. In which case, they usually a very small team, maybe one or two person, the second person being usually a relative, or maybe a spouse, and then the other model, which is, you know, growing a company out of it and, you know, getting on all employees and building a company and sort of scaling, where the creator walks away a little bit from the post-production work and the creative labor and then focuses on like business development and finding new opportunities for the company.
Yeah, it's become that way. It didn't start that way. Like with We're Alive, I will be honest, I spent every single episode like editing We're Alive in a full capacity. I mean, we did have other editors on it, but they would be like, okay, here's the first stage of editing, go ahead and start doing it. And then I would pick it up and basically do a lot of the sound design, a lot of the editing, change out performances, you know, swap stuff. So we had different stages at that point, but still I was doing the scheduling, the writing, the directing, the producing. So it in time, it sort of has evolved into being able to have multiple people work on stuff. Also because, you know, you only have so much time, and having a little one especially makes things really hard to balance that out. Like it's especially right now when you don't have childcare as easily accessible, you have to kind of find a balance between it all so that you can still be a parent but also still be a producer. And yeah, it is a complicated scenario, and you got to find the right balance of the equation to make it work. But it's it ultimately, you know, the nice thing is because I've stepped in every shoe of every role in the production, I know what is involved in it. So then I can actually find the best way to fine tune it and make sure that the sort of the production machine flows in a way that's, you know, optimal.
Of course, yeah. And then it will allow you to kind of scale it as much as you can. I have a 2-year-old too, so like I
yeah, you know the pain. It's hard. It's really hard. And you want to be the right parent, but also you have so many other responsibilities. And how do you switch your brain from one to the other? It's the human equation we got to deal with, you know?
Were you working on the side as well at the time, at the beginning, like the first 2 or 3 years of your life? Did you have another job?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, I was working pretty much full time as an engineer and as a staff member at a Dodge College of Film Media Arts, where I'm now a professor. But I was a staff member there, basically running the facilities for the digital arts department. That it was the animation side for, you know, render farms and system management and a lot of tech side of things. I have a background in an engineering certifications, and so I have a very heavy technological, you know, orientation that allowed me to sort of keep afloat during those really lean years. But also focusing on really what I wanted to do, which was create and write. And I'm able to do that now for the most part full time and then teach part time.
Did you go to film school or not at all?
I did. Yeah. So my background was I had a really interesting beginning in where I come from was I did the weekend shoots with my friends when I was in high school and did a lot of independent, like, oh, we got a mini DV camera. Let's shoot a movie. You know, let's do this and that. And well, it's 8mm at the time. So I would do that a lot. And I loved making films, and I got in the media arts program in high school. So I really wanted to go to film school, and I applied, I got in. But then I realized the cost of it all.
Yeah.
And I made it to like one semester and said, I'm not going to be able to, the numbers and figures don't make sense. I'm not able to even take out the loans that I need.
Right.
I'm not going to be able to finish this. This is not going to work for me. So I ended up going into the military, becoming a broadcast engineer in the Army, serving there, and then also coming back to school to finish up my film degree, and sort of did a simultaneous enrollment. I got deployed overseas, came back, finished off my degree. And so it took a while to go through college and military at the same time. But in the end, they sort of kind of fed into each other, and it made me a better storyteller in the end. Because, you know, one of the things they always tell you in film school is, like, what is your perspective? What do you know?
Right.
And I've been able to use my military perspective as a very big influence into, you know, what I've created and my style of writing.
What other thing did you learn from that experience? I have now like 3 friends who have heavy military backgrounds. One of that I've met in film school, others that I've met in other places, and one in France. And they all came back different, and they all have this same similar aura. And I'm curious to hear your perspective on that, and what else did you get out of it that might have helped you.
I think part of it is discipline, because when in the military, you sort of learn that you can do things faster than normal people. I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but in the military, they always try and like simplify things down and see how efficiently you can do something. And efficiency becomes like a big key, and it's kind of a ruler of my life is, if you can do something faster and better, why not do it that way? But you can, like, it's the simplest things of like, oh, you know, you can actually take like a 2 or 3 minute shower and be done and clean and be on your way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of efficiency is like, oh, okay. You know, that's a good way to look at things, is you can realize that you're not inhibited by, you know, how slow you do something. You can do it fairly quickly. And motivation is one of those military things they always tell you is, you're not motivated enough if you don't move fast enough, kind of way.
Right.
But at the same time, it also gives you like a discipline of understanding of how to execute something and how to be a leader in some ways. Like I am by no means the best leader of you know, anybody, but I think that it did teach me a lot of how to manage people and manage situations. And it's interesting what you walk away from it, both good and bad. There are some bad parts of the military that kind of carry on with you through everything, but then you find other ways to channel it and other ways to express it, depending on sort of, you know, what you've been through and what you've experienced. So it's a mixed bag. It's definitely something that can help, because it lets you see the world and lets you, you know, get an influence of what's going on out there and be outside yourself. And also, you lose a lot of yourself, and you don't have a lot of freedoms in the military. So you sort of respect that a little bit more once you come out of that environment.
Do you apply the same principles that you got from the military in order to kind of get you going through your writing day or your writing routine?
Weirdly enough, yes and no. It's hard to say. I think that in terms of writing, I did a lot of writing before the military, so I had some experience through there. But I will say, though, that through the military, you get a bit of a different sense of the voices of other people. And what I mean by that is you're exposed to so many different types of people in the military from so many different backgrounds from all over the world that you have a little bit more of a viewpoint of, well, what happens when you put a mixed bag of really different characters together? What's the sort of output that you get? And that's sort of the military is you see people that come from so many different walks of life, have been through so many different situations. They all have a different story and background, but yet they're thrown together in one mixing pot and you say, okay, how do these people work? And that right there gives you a little bit of the perception of the human equation of what is it that really means and drives us the things that we do. And also you have times where you're just sitting there in the military doing nothing. And all you have is your brain to sort of like keep you occupied, to start to think of things and observe things and you know, watch what's going on. And so it's really interesting, sort of the side things that kind of come along from the situations. And I will say, though, like after my deployment into the military, I will say that made me a better storyteller. It made me focus on a lot of the things that did work and didn't work in my writing and sort of let me go to the next level, I think, in terms of understanding and having sort of a perspective that was a little bit more genuine and a little bit, you know, more true to life than I had before. When I had only been, you know, influenced by my small little world. In terms of like what you're talking about with page count and such, I think it did improve a little bit. I think it sort of you just kind of drive on, you keep on moving, and then you'll go back and do revisions. And I think that's part of anything is you just have to keep moving and keep going and, you know, put pages behind you. And then, you know, you're going to write garbage. And sometimes you have to go back, rewrite it and throw pages out and do other things and go, oh, you know, this works, this doesn't work. So it's adaptation, I think, is a big part of it.
Where are you from originally? Are you from California?
Yeah, no, I'm from California, and weirdly enough, I'm actually from a small town in California. I would say quote unquote small town because it's not LA. I don't live in LA. I actually live in Orange, which is a very small community in Orange County. And actually, weirdly enough, my family's been here. Ooh, going on, what's like 7 generations now? Like my family was part of the original founders of the town back when it was like all orange groves and dirt fields. We've been here a very long time. And I actually have part of my family has native blood that actually goes back to some of the roots of the state. So it's really interesting how people are like, oh, you're from California? Yeah, I'm actually from California. Like it's where we've been. And my city has especially grown over the years many, many times over to where, you know, it's the city and state of LA has just, you know, grown exponentially over the past 20 years plus.
I was going to ask you if the military was also like a way to kind of escape.
Oh, yeah.
I thought about it. And then I realized you also came back to California. So was that part of the reason you left, and then what was the reason to come back?
Well, a couple of reasons. The interesting part about that, yes, I did leave to try and go out and see the world and get a different perspective, and a little bit of my rebellious nature at the time was like, no, I need to be my own person. I need to be able to break free of my past to be able to, mm-hmm. to take hold of my future. But at the same time, when I came back, I also understood the value and a necessity of family and the amount of support that you get in that structure. Because like, honestly, when I did a lot of film productions and I did a lot of productions, I would grab my brothers. I would grab my sister. I'd grab my dad. Even my dad was a sound guy on one of my films to that extent. And I've always relied on my family, and that environment is very supportive in the things that you want to do sometimes. And so you can do things on the cheap, or you can pay people, or you can just ask family members. That seems to be the third little prong in that those options. And family members will always be there for you. They'll sort of, you know, if they love being involved, they can definitely, you know, be more involved. And my family is pretty creative.
Did you meet your wife after or before the military?
So, yeah, no, I met my wife in college. Actually, she was one of the inspirations to do sort of this thing, because she brought podcasts to me and said, hey, listen to this podcast. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't even know these things existed. And weirdly enough, when we first started We're Alive, we cast the role of Lizzie and for a different actor, and then that actor ended up getting sick and then was a no-show. And so I was like, hey, my girlfriend at the time, Blair, I said, hey, would you mind filling in? She's like, sure. And then she ended up becoming the full role of Lizzie. So Lizzie in the series is actually my wife.
I see.
And so we've lived happily ever after since, going on, what is it now? Almost 10 years, 10 or 11 years together. So as long as the series.
Is she part of the Weyland production core team?
Yes and no. She's always there in the background supporting, reading scripts, telling me that this is stupid or this is great. She is sort of like the way that we've balanced out our lives is I'm the audio component and she's the visual component.
Got it.
A lot of the documentary stuff that you see and the videos that are behind some of the We're Alive production stuff is done by her, which is nice to, you know, have that sort of balance and creative team behind you.
Yeah.
And also in your partner, to be able to have somebody who has a creative background is nice in terms of understanding what you're trying to do.
Yeah. And it's also nice to also have separate activities and separate lives as well at the same time. So my wife wrote Crypto Z. So, and I took it from there and worked with her the whole time. But she writes novels, and I take care of all the other stuff.
Nice. It's good. It's good to have that, you know, partnership, because then the time you're working is the time you're also spending together. Good and bad.
Yeah. It's either paradise or hell.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. It's you know, you have to also be your support and also their critic, and that's a tough balance.
All right, let's not get into the spouse work relationship. Were you able to put your little one in as a zombie in We Are Alive?
He was a little too little at the time. Matter of fact, he actually wasn't even born yet before We Are Alive came out. So he hasn't been in the series yet. He might be in the future, but I did put my nephew in the series. My nephew did play the baby Nicholas. So he, matter of fact, actually, we put a microphone in the delivery room when he was born. So I have a little bit of his birth on the audio, which is crazy. So we have actually a baby at day zero in the production, which I don't know how many other productions can say that.
No, that's pretty cool. I've put mine, I have a 2-year-old girl. I've put her she didn't last very long. She has a very small part, which is, you know, probably like 5 seconds of a baby Iceman, but I don't think anybody can notice it.
It's nice though to have that extra voice, and honestly, now that Augie is my son, is getting a little bit older, I definitely will have use him in the future. And weirdly enough, actually yesterday we were talking about, so Augie, you want to be an actor? And he's like, yeah, that sounds like fun. So we're like, all right, let's see. Let's try and be afraid. And we went through all the motions to see if he could do it. And he did a great job. It was really funny to see him try and act. And, Dad, that's too hard. And it's like, well, see, this is the hard part is directing kids. Very difficult.
I had one more question about, because you mentioned something really interesting about the military. And I think it reflects also in why military movies and war movies are kind of cool. All the characters, you know, are kind of the same. There's not, you know, you can cast different actors, but they end up having the same haircut. They end up wearing the same costume. Sure, you know, one can have like his sleeves rolled up. One can be with no shirts on. They all have the same age. You know, there's only so much you can do to create contrast and dynamic in those characters. So the pleasure of watching those movies is actually to see how all of them kind of take on their own character and react differently to the circumstances and the context they're put in, and how those relationship forms are being torn apart. And it's a challenge in movies visually, because there is only so much you can do. But I could imagine for voice only, how do you go about creating that kind of contrast and dynamic between your characters on the page, but also in your casting and in your directing?
So that's one, I think one of the strong suits of We're Alive is the diversity of people in uniform. Yeah. Because by nature, with the Army and all sort of military services, they're trying to make everybody the same. Like, they wear the same uniform. It's the definition of uniform. And so when you're, you know, on this side of things trying to do it creatively, it is a little difficult to try and make them contrast. But one of the nice things about having a background as a soldier is you see that they are not all the same. They're not just mindless zombies, to use that phrase. And they are unique in their own way. They're people. And I think that's one of the very big problems with most military perceptions, is that these are not people.
Right.
These are people that are just take orders, and they don't have any sort of like mental, you know, acuity behind them. And no, I would say more so that than anybody, that soldiers, they have a personality, they have a background, they have their own perceptions. They need to have some sort of, you know, credence to their way of thinking, and all that comes from, you know, real life. And I think being in the Army and seeing that, and seeing everyone who has, you know, everyone takes an order very differently, and everyone, like, you take a look at something as simple as, say, preparing your gear for going on a deployment. There's some people who are like, okay, I got this packed in my gear. I got, you know, everything buttoned up tight, knit, zip tie this, put, you know, 100 mph cord around here, make sure all these things are done. It's spending hours trying to get everything ready. And then you got another soldier who just opens up his locker, dumps everything in the pack, zips it up, and says, "All right, I'm ready." So it's, you get that polarity in just the simplest tasks of whatever they do, because everybody does something differently. It's like, what is their motivation and how they handle it becomes core to what makes a character a character. So, like, if you think about those two different characters of examples I gave you, the way that one of them speaks versus the way that another one speaks is going to really kind of influence, you know, how they react. Like, you can imagine the person who has all their stuff prepared and very, very high and tight. They're very by the book in the way that they talk. They don't have a lot of excess words. There's not a lot of character to it. But the person that throws their stuff in the pack, they can be a little bit more lackadaisical. They can, you know, tell you a story in the middle of doing something that while the other person wouldn't do that. They'd be more like, why give you information about myself? Like, even myself in the military, I would not let people call me by my first name. And so that can be a character trait of the person who is, you know, getting their gear all high and tight and perfect, versus the other person just goes by their first name. And the second part of that is the core of who these people are have to be real humans. They have to come from some sort of part of your brain or some sort of inspiration in real life that makes them real. Because when you're trying to create a character, no one can create someone from scratch. It's almost impossible unless, you know, you do it biologically. But you have to think of, okay, where did this person come from, where their influences are, what their background is. But if you take somebody that you already know in real life, and, you know, maybe you had a coworker who was really lazy, and maybe you can apply the voice that you have in your head of saying things the way they would say, you know, apply that to the lazier soldier versus the person who is a manager, who is like really, you know, anal about everything and like, no, you got to make sure that that's, you know, that floor is polished. Well, what does it matter? We're leaving tomorrow when we're never coming back to this room. No, but it needs to be polished for just the sake of it. You know, there's, you just have to start to think about, you know, where in your life you could have a parallel to hear these voices and make them real. And everyone's process is different, but I like to try and find somebody or some sort of thing in real life that inspires that, because then it'll become from a place that's very genuine.
Do you hear dialogue first, or do you hear or do you see situation first? I love that you're you know, what you were saying, in some sense, like it really reflects in the show is how you find strategies in the dialogue for little moments like that to happen and help characterize those characters. But I'm curious to see what you hear first when you write.
It's interesting because I think my style is that I'll develop an outline and I'll have the outline all planned out ahead of time because you need to have a roadmap. If you don't have a roadmap, then you're just going to go off in various directions and have no idea where you're going. But then when you have that roadmap in place and you have a good outline and you put it in the equation, and then you let the characters go into those equations. And it's interesting because for me, I'll have my objectives in the scene. Like I need to have this person end up here and I need to have this person do this and this person do this. And sometimes those objectives are, you know, counter to the other person. Right. And so it's sort of like an experiment to see, like, okay, let's see how these characters interact. And that's the process of writing for me, in a way, is you let the characters roam free, you let them speak their voices, and you sort of let them play out in your head to try and achieve their objectives in the way that they would. And then other people would be counter to those objectives, and their motivations may be, you know, crossed of those. So it's kind of like you kind of have to roll the dice and see what happens and let yourself have that freedom to let the characters speak to you and speak for themselves in the scenes, but also have a good set of outlines. So it's what's given you the confines of, you know, the character wouldn't do this. You know, the character, the lazy character, all of a sudden wouldn't be the first one out the door. They'd be the last one out the door. And so stuff like that kind of comes into play. And if you really understand and know who your characters are, then it gets a little easier. And I will say, though, and then after time, and one of the reasons why the series gets better as it goes is because you can hear those characters in your head for the first time. Once you've recorded one session with them, you can maybe start to develop a relationship and understand what that character would say, because all of a sudden now they're in your head and you can use that application to apply it to, you know, any scene.
Totally. You get really attached to them, actually. And it comes quite fast, like, you know, after an episode already, you're like, oh, okay, so he's the funny one, but everybody makes fun of him. And then, you know, it's like there is this, like, really, really subtle build-up and character formation that crystallized in the listener's mind. And I'm very admirative of that. Because it's really easy to screw up.
Yeah, it is. People know when people aren't being genuine or something is not, you know, true to that person. I mean, we've seen TV shows and be like, wait a minute, they wouldn't do that. That's not something that their character would do.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it becomes disingenuous.
But the medium of podcasting is, I find it quite unforgiving. Like if you lose me on, like, at some level, it's very hard to get me back into it.
Oh, definitely. It's your ear is detectable of, like, it can detect when something sounds wrong or sounds right very, very easily. It's a lot more sensitive of an instrument than people understand or value at various points.
And you don't have the benefit of people sitting in a dark room and having paid $10 to be there, because they're just going to stay there and watch the whole film. Like, even if, you know, maybe they'll not be completely happy, but at least they'll stay there. With podcasting, like, they're gone. They're just going to do their own, like, they're living their life at the same time.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that happens with episode one is... Episode one becomes your most important episode of all, because if they don't follow that one, they're not going to follow the rest of the series.
On the other hand, do you find that if you've managed to deliver on that, do you find on the opposite that people are as quote unquote addicted, although I hate the word, than they would be on a TV show, for example?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I've seen from the show being on for so long and being on the servers is that people really get attached to the characters. Our re-listen rate is incredible. I really wish that a lot of charts would adhere to understanding the re-listen rate of this stuff. Unfortunately, they don't. But when you have the character, you know, in your head and you create them in your own mind, you're an active participant in that, and it's a very intimate relationship between you and the listener, and it's their part of the story as much as you are the telling of it. They're the visual component, you're the auditory component, And together you are part of the listener's, you know, experience. And I think that's a relationship that a lot of people don't understand. But then when you see these people who have listened to it, like we have listeners who listened to it 10s of 30 times, more than I have in some ways. And they really like grab onto it because it becomes familiar to them because it's a part of them as well. It puts them in a time and place of their lives and they can kind of go back to it in a way.
It reminds me of something that was really, really striking to me is how good your sense of rhythm is with managing the different strategies you're employing to tell the story. So, for example, you know, action scenes and shootings and zombie appearing. It depends from episode to episode, but sometimes they're just here as like punctuation to get us from a scene to another. Sometimes there is the voiceover that just kind of like helps us bridge with this part of the story that we see from far away. For example, in the last episode, where like he describes what happens on the bridge, and I was so amazed to see how like every time you have a very good sense of the energy of the scene and how you know how to like surprise us and take us out, and then change gear and then go back to it in a very efficient way.
Yeah, there's a digestion with audio. And like if anybody watches the movie Saving Private Ryan, this is a very common thing inside of films is if you have constant berating action or sound that just is overwhelming, the audience will get tired out and they will lose focus. So it's almost like the pacing of everything has to be a little bit of give and take, like give them a lot, then let them pull it back. Give them a little bit more, then pull it back. And it's sort of like you can do that in the writing and then you support it more in the post-production and the editing because then you can really hear it and how it's executed there. But it really does have to have the sort of give and take with the audience of not giving them too much at once and letting them really to understand what's going on and not, you know, continually beat them over the head over and over and over, because then they lose focus.
Yeah, and then there's this element of clarity and confusion, which you play with very, very well. Sometimes, you know, we find ourselves confused, but it's always purposeful to create this feeling of, you know, war and battle scenes. But it never lasts too long that I'm lost in the story. And this is something that I hear too often in other audio dramas, where I feel like sometimes, you know, if the story is a little bit not very clear, a bit confusing, and I'm starting to wonder what's going on, I really completely get lost and I just, you know, I sort of like give up.
Yeah, that's definitely...
Because actually it makes me feel like I have to do all the work of imagining the world, but also having to imagine... reconstruct the story, and I feel like it's just asking too much of me.
That's part of the experience, part of doing this for so long, and it whittles down to one principle in creating audio, is that confusion is the killer of audio dramas or audio entertainment in that sense. If the audience is confused at what's going on, you have lost them, because a wandering mind in an audio drama isn't focusing on what's going on in the present. They're thinking about the past. And then they're not an active participant in your scene. In video, it doesn't matter. You can look up, look down. You can see from side to side what's going on the screen, and it really doesn't matter as much as say an audio drama, because you can catch back up. The pace is variable. You're like, oh, okay, that's where they're at. That's where we're going on. These are the people in the scenes. But with audio, you lose them. You lose them.
Do you do improvs at all?
Yes, just one second. Oh, never mind. My dog was scratching at the door, and then he decided not to scratch anymore.
I think maybe your cat.
Yes, we do some improvisation in our show. There's a lot of it inside of Gold Rush, because the artists that we use for that show, a lot of them were improvisational artists, so they have a lot of talent in that area. And then sometimes we would let it happen on the page where... it's something that, like, I'll put in there improvisation reaction of this. Like, if something's going bad and I want the characters to argue sometimes and everyone's voicing their opinion at once, I'll just let them go. And I'm not going to write every single line, because then it would be just filled with pages of blah, 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 blah. So some of the times when, like, there's a scene, I forget where it is, but where people are pestering Michael, like, and he goes, I don't know. I don't know. And he gets really upset and it elevated. I let all the actors roam free. I was like, I'm going to sit back. Everyone, you know sort of what your positions and stakes are in this scene. Everyone's got their own opinion of what's going on. And Michael's not answering any of your questions. So bug the hell out of him. Go. And you let him go.
Did you always knew that We're Alive would be a platform, a storytelling platform for... It sounds a little bit like the epidemic and the zombie aspect of the story is actually, it's in the world, but it's not the story, which allows you to kind of branch out and explore the world in with different story arcs. So was there always this idea of creating a storytelling platform, or was that came about as you went to in during
yeah,
the years?
Yeah, that kind of, so I believe it came about over the years, because originally, the characters were about, I mean, the story was about these characters in this time and this place in LA, because I was familiar with the location, and it was, the world kind of lended to itself in a lot of ways to audio, because then it becomes very limited. Only the characters that are alive are the ones you hear, and the ones you don't hear are usually infected. So it made it really, you know, a much better atmosphere for recording audio and audio storytelling. But then I also started to discover other stories and other things of the world, because the nice thing about creating stories is it's sort of like you have these, it's an equation, really, is what is going on in the world outside of these people that would contribute to this happening and this happening. And it kind of becomes like a really big open world that you can continually add on more to.
Do you feel like it's strategically more interesting to further in the same world to extract the most value out of it? So because the audience is already there, because you've already done, you know, tons of marketing work, and you kind of like build on something that's a foundation that's already there.
Yeah, there's an added bonus when you're like, it's the same thing, like think of Game of Thrones, and they're doing the spin-off series now. That has a lot of value because of the backgrounds of what's going on, and people are already familiar with the world. So that really makes it a big jumping off point for people, be like, oh, I want to listen to that, or I want to watch that, because it'll give me more of what the thing I liked before. And that's the reason why we have so many sequels now, is people realize that versus so long ago that we didn't have any. So it does end up adding into things, and it's you're building up on the original mound. I will say, though, that you also have to be careful, because sometimes when you create something new that is not in tune with the previous one, or it's so radically different that it ruins it, that is a problem too, because you devalue the original one and people are like, I don't want to watch that. Like, I hate to say it, Game of Thrones is another example, is a lot of people didn't like the last season, so they devalued the previous ones. So it's like that's the kind of thing that might happen, is if you do it the right way or the wrong way, it can come back and bite you. The flip side of that is if you create something new, then you don't have to worry about what was previously done. You can do something that has a different theming, a different pacing, a different time, place, and energy and characters, which is the kind of the reason why I like doing these other stories that I'm doing, is because I'm not building off of something that's so pre-existing that I'm constantly fact-checking, like, wait, what happened there, this? No, you start fresh, and it's kind of nice to have a new perspective coming into something.
So We're Alive is a massive success right now. Would you agree with that?
In a humblest way, yes. But it's still... I think it's success in its own right, but I see a bigger future ahead of it, potentially, that could be even more. It's one of these things where I think that there's an audience for audio, but I think that there could be an even bigger audience, possibly, if it went to the visual market, because, you know, discovering new things like this and discovering new stories is hard, and I think that some people don't give audio as much credit as they do some of the visual stuff they see.
So I have to ask you now, is there any talks happening behind the scenes?
There's always been talks, and there's always been little things here and there. I'm mostly focused on trying to get the other series that I have, the audio series for We're Alive, done. I will say it is, especially with the pandemic going on right now, it is, some of those talks are very difficult. Productions all around are, you know, getting cut down to nothing. So that is very difficult right now. Hopefully in the future that'll change. But also because there is a show like Walking Dead and people are getting a little tired of zombies, that it's sometimes hard to express to people high up who have, you know, who control the purse strings in production, how we differ from all those things. So it's a little complicated. I wish I could say, yes, we have something coming out at X time, but it's an ongoing conversation with various places to try and see how we can go to the next level and do it properly. Because a lot of times when you do adaptations and sometimes they don't work, you only get one chance on doing it, and then you won't have that chance again for at least a long time after.
Right. All right, I just want to change gear for a second here. Before Real Life was a success, quote unquote, did you have any moment where you lost confidence and felt like you just wouldn't be able to continue?
Yeah, I think that happens in little bursts here and there. I don't think I ever fully lost faith in the series because of the fan following that we had with it. I was pretty confident in the way that it would continue forward. But then there are times when you're dealing with stuff behind the scenes with certain actors and things where things get complicated, where it's this person is not available anymore, and you have to sort of like find a way around that, or there's somebody's moving away, so you don't have them in the room with everybody anymore, and you have to adjust for that. So there's a lot of times I think it gets really tricky and difficult, and as I think every writer goes through various stages of what they're writing and be like, oh, this is crap and this doesn't work, or this is great and this, or this, you know, you self-doubt seems to be part of the process of writing. And even as I was writing continuations of We're Alive and Descendants, when I was doing the first couple drafts, some of them I was like, is this really working? Is this character working? Is this new and fresh enough? Or am I going in the right direction? Especially when you're creating something new that hasn't been established. There is a lot of self-doubt. And I think that it's part of the process. But the difference is that the better artist you are is you understand what works and what doesn't. And then you try to adjust and fix from there. And that is what will set you apart, is that in the storyteller process, if you know and feel something is wrong and you try and fix it and you can find a way to fix it, that's what makes you the better storyteller. And I think that we as artists have to continually evolve. Otherwise, we are going to make stagnant work. And that self-doubt will always try and push you to do the things that you do the best.
And how did you overcome those moments? How did you do to kind of like pull yourself forward and like look past, you know, learn how to look past those dark times and like keep moving forward?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, sometimes you'll look at other things on social media and like, I'll look at some pieces of art and be like, wait, this is not very good, but people love it. Why is that going? why is this succeeding and this failing when this is so much better, in my opinion? And that you kind of have to ignore that. You have to sort of it's the development process of becoming an artist, is that you have to sort of see the value in yourself and the value of what you're doing, and know that if you're constantly trying to improve and make things better, then they will. It's an ongoing process, and it's a struggle that I think everyone has to go through as an artist. And you know, I can point to times that happened with me where, you know, you doubt yourself and you doubt what you're doing. But you have to sort of like look back and say, like right now I can turn around and look at the shelf of all the chapters that I wrote, and it's a huge amount. And I can look at, you know, say, look, there's that entire shelf of things that you've written, something that people have loved and enjoyed, and people have commented great comments. Sometimes people don't. Sometimes they'll give you a bad review and things that they don't like. And you have to realize that everybody is different and everybody receives something different, and whether or not, you know, maybe 9 people will love it and one person doesn't, you can't focus on that one. You can't please everybody. You're going to have some people who will not like you for the way that you're doing something, or the way that you're, you know, executing something. Like there's some people in the audio drama community that don't like what I do for whatever reason, or don't like my style, and that's fine. You just kind of have to look at it and say, okay, that is your perspective. I'm just going to keep on rolling on and moving forward in my way. And the difference is where you don't quit and you keep on moving on to the next thing and try something else, try something new. And if it doesn't work, find out what didn't work and fix it and move on. Like my senior thesis that I talked about earlier, that animation that was completely horrible. I looked at that as a complete failure, but I also looked at it as a success because it spurred something new, because I saw what was worth and had value to it and threw the stuff away that didn't. And that filtration process makes you a better artist.
On the same exact note, do you feel like your relationship with yourself and your own writing has evolved in all those years? I'm going to stop saying 11 years is dumb. Because I think you and I like are both ruthless with the work, and like I'm sure you don't have any hesitation to cut stuff out and rewrite stuff, even though you may have like spent hours making this. I guess it's called confidence.
Yeah, that builds over time. And I think that that's something that the more that you do, the more confidence that you have. I think that just comes with any nature of any project, is you start to develop a sense of self and a sense of what it is that you are strongest in and your style. Because as a teacher, one of the things I tell my students is that the process of writing is the process of finding your voice on paper. And only you will be able to develop that. You can't write somebody else's stuff. That's not going to work. And especially in this business, you have to be able to, you know, continue on with your voice, because that is what's going to stand out at the end of the day. And also the reason why you will get hired for a project or not get hired for something. And while you might doubt yourself at certain times, you constantly are trying to develop that. And for me, there are stuff that I'll look back and be like, oh, this is not as good as I could have made it, and I could make this better, or this, that, and I can eat myself away, or I can continue working and continue doing the next project and continuing trying to do more and more, instead of getting hung up on the details of saying, you know, well, maybe you're not good enough anymore, or maybe you've lost your mojo, whatever made you good before will not make you good now. And it's the process of not quitting. And there have been many artists that I have known along the way that, you know, they've moved on into other career fields because they didn't want to go through that humility process of failing and trying again, and if that didn't work, do something else, or, you know, that kind of process. And it's hard, and it's not for everybody, and it's, you know, the world is not forgiving sometimes at the same notion, but the ability of not quitting will keep you getting better and keep you moving forward, and never giving up is I think part of the process of, you know, finding your own voice.
This is so great. No, I'm like completely 100% with you. On the flip side of that, what were the things that specific to podcasting that were like telling you, yeah, keep going?
I think the big thing for me was audience. I think the one element that kept me moving forward and understanding that this is something that I really should continue doing is seeing the audience feedback, seeing them at live shows, crossing the entire country to come and see us. That was something that I thought was invaluable. Like that, to me as an artist, to see people love your work enough to be able to become, you know, uber fans of it and buy merchandise and tell their friends about it and continue listening over and over and over, that to me made it worth it. It makes me look at this and say, okay, somebody enjoys it out there. And I've gotten letters from people who say that, you know, I had eye surgery and this is what got me through the pain, or I was stuck in a point in my life and I was able to listen to your series and it really spoke to me and got me through some tough times. And that's kind of the core of why we even do art in the beginning, is we are trying to give people a different perspective or give them something else outside themselves to give them inspiration and move forward. Like for me, I have movies that I'll watch when I'm down, or a show that I'll watch that really brings me up and makes me laugh and makes me forget some of the harsh realities of what's going on around us. And especially now, we need a little bit of escapism. And I think that when you see in the eyes of your listeners, so to speak, and what and how it affects them, it drives you. It says, you know what? You are creating something outside of yourself that not only lives on past you, but will live on in other people. And for me as an artist, that's what I want to do, is it's the achievement of immortality, is you get to live on forever past the point of your own flesh.
Yeah, I'm not going to say anything after that, because what else can I say? this is a great ending. Last question. What was the most generous thing that someone did to help you?
I would say probably the meaningful support that I get is from the fans and people who have done something There have people who have made masks for We're Alive. We have somebody who's doing like distribution of merchandise in the UK because they love the show so much. And so I think I can't ever pick one little thing, but all the many things that the fans do. I mean, I've had people support us by editing code on websites, and some people who have become, you know, webmasters and help with server stuff or help us with this or that and make sure that the show continues on, because, you know, our website got hacked many different times and somebody was there to help us out with that. So, I mean, all these different pieces of what has kept us going have really come from the audience and the fans. And I think that's something that I have to look back and say and be very thankful and grateful for is I don't think I would be able to continue if it wasn't for those sort of even the smallest support elements of fans out there that, you know, continually keep us going. And even interviews like this, you know, that really give credence and merit to what we're doing. And it drives us forward and keeps us creating.
Thank you, Casey. This was really great. And thank you for taking the time. I can't wait for our listeners to go and discover Gold Rush and all your previous seasons. Is there anything else you'd like to tell them about?
Sure. So we have Bronzeville season 2 is coming out. That's been a good year of work right there, just trying to get everyone together and make that process come to life. And it's a great series. Season 2 is, I believe, even better than the first one. Does some things with audio that we haven't done before, and further support. I mean, we have a Patreon channel. If people like We're Alive and they want to hear behind the scenes commentary of us talking about some of the reasons why and some stuff that got cut and added in, and sometimes we even go to maps and look, say, hey, here's this area and this and such. So they can support us on Patreon through Whalen Productions, or just, you know, following us on Facebook or Twitter, We're Alive, or myself, Casey Whalen, or Whalen Prod, as I'm on a lot of these social media tags. And you know, telling your friends to listen is any way to help the show is helps us in some capacity.
I highly, highly recommend you guys check out We Are Live. It is an amazing show. It's going to completely hook you up until the last minute. So thank you so much, Casey. And I hope you get to come back and tell us about Bronzeville and the other Audible things that we didn't get to talk about, actually.
That'd be great. Yeah, I have always working pretty much every day. So thank you, Hadrian. I really appreciate this.
My pleasure, Casey. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to be up to date with the latest news about CryptoZ, you can always text 646-229-3423. This is where we'll announce the date of the reboot, and this is where we announce our next live event. CryptoZ has been selected to participate to a really important event mid-September, so until then, episodes might drop in a more erratic way as we're preparing for it. And I'll share more information about that as the event approaches. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.